Time now for Connecting the Diocese. Connecting the Diocese is a production of the Diocese of La Crosse. Here's host Jack Socha.
Thank you for tuning in, Connecting the Diocese. A little postscript to the Kathy Cooper food show I thought you might find interesting. Not long ago, scientists in southern Vietnam found a medium-sized carved stone table buried underground for 2,000 years, which they ascertained was made to chop up herbs to make curry. That's right. More than 2,000 years ago, they were chopping up herbs to make curry, which they discovered were surprisingly the same as the kind of stuff we eat today. How did they do this? Embedded into the rock were microscopic particles of the actual herbs they were using, and they were able to detect these things and figure it out. Of course, the bigger question that came to my mind was 2,000 years ago, did somebody's wife say, "Honey, did you clean the spice table before you put it away?" "Oh yeah, dear, I sure did." I'll be right back with more real scientific talk with Father James Krasinski right after this on Connecting the Diocese. I'm sure at some point you've heard the phrase, "try to keep up." Well, at the Diocese of La Crosse, they try to keep up. And as the host of this particular show, I try to keep up, and sometimes I'm even surprised. For example, now, I was looking at some items on Amazon Prime, and I decided to go look at the podcasts that were available, and I decided to type in Connecting the Diocese, and would you believe, there was Connecting the Diocese as a podcast that you can listen to through Amazon Music, which is part of Amazon Prime. Yeah, the logo was there and everything, the most current show, the whole works. I was frankly surprised. Apparently, the folks at the communications department are really keeping up. So if you find yourself listening to the broadcast, but sometimes would like to hear it on the internet, and maybe you don't have iTunes, and maybe you don't really know how to navigate and get into a podcasting mode, well, you can just go to Amazon, and if you've got an Amazon Prime account, click on Amazon Music and Podcast, and then type in Connecting the Diocese, and you can hear the show. Another great source for all kinds of content from the Diocese of La Crosse is YouTube. That's correct. Lots of homilies, lots of special services, special masses are on YouTube. Rebroadcast, for example, of the recent ordination is on YouTube. Plus, we have some specialty items from our Family Life Department. The bishop frequently has some of his messages up there as well. It's a really good place to go check out. You just go to YouTube and just search for Diocese of La Crosse, Wisconsin, and they'll start showing up. Different styles of shows and different lengths of shows. This show tends to be a bit more like something from public radio where we look at a topic in a long-form examination. Other things are shorter. You can catch the news from Casa Hogar. You can even hear Monsignor Hirsch singing the Salvation Poem. Been up there for several years now. But also, don't forget to go to diolc.org, the Diocese of La Crosse website, for the latest information and news and announcements, and also links to many other great pieces of information and inspiration. diolc.org.
Catholic news and interviews. This is Connecting the Diocese.
Well, I want to welcome back to the show Father James Krasinski. Father, which parish are you in for those who don't know you?
Hey, Jack. Yeah, I'm at St. Olaf Parish in Eau Claire, Wisconsin.
Okay.
Serving the north side of the city.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I want to get you on periodically to talk about things that essentially a lot of people, both non-Catholic and Catholic, don't have a clue about. For example, now, if I was to mention, particularly to people who really don't know much at all about the Catholic Church, because maybe they're not Catholics, what does the Church have to do with science? Well, the first thing they would probably think of was complaining that actually, no, the earth doesn't really revolve around the sun. That was a long time ago. Was it 1976? No, it was...
Depending on who you listen to on YouTube these days, you
yeah,
think
it yeah, was... Yeah, no, it goes back to Copernicus hundreds of years ago. The point of this, there's a lot more science going on at the Vatican and all over the world than the average person would even believe. And we have a Vatican Observatory, and where is it now?
Yeah, so the Vatican Observatory, there's actually two locations. The traditional headquarters is at Castel Gandolfo in Rome, and that's kind of now where they have their primary administrative offices and also their meteorite collection. It's a little-known thing that over the centuries, the Vatican Observatory has a very extensive meteorite collection that's world-renowned. And then their observational headquarters is outside of Tucson, Arizona, up on top of, I believe it's Mount Graham, and they have which ironically now in the professional astronomy world is considered the grandfather or grandmother, whatever, of telescopes, of the new generation technology telescopes, meaning that it was built with this this new technology to make incredibly huge telescope mirrors, incredibly light and hyper accurate. The founder who wanted to test this couldn't really get a professional organization to really support it. And Roger Angel said to Father Coyne, former director of the Vatican Observatory, "I want to try this new spin cast technique on creating telescope mirrors. If it works, I'll give you the first mirror." And Father Coyne said, "Done." It was a success. The mirror lab, ironically, it was in the basement of the old Jewish synagogue on campus. And so as the lore goes at the Vatican Observatory, mirror was made by an angel in a Jewish synagogue and with Roger Angel as the creator.
Oh, man.
But now because of the success of that, and so now whether it's the giant Magellan telescope that's going up in Chile or something, all those telescopes really owe their mirrors in terms of the design back to the Vatican Observatory telescope in Tucson. So it's not a cliche or niche-y thing or some type of propaganda. It's a real active scientific study telescope that is respected in the professional world and to this day does its own forms of professional observation.
Interesting that had they not been open to trying it,
yep.
So many places we go, we can't make a buck on it, so we're not even going to worry about it.
Yep.
But and because of that, now these more improved telescopes are all over the world using the same basic technique that was proved through the one from the Vatican Observatory.
Exactly.
And again, who would have thunk it, as they say?
Yep.
You know, it's really good.
Yeah.
Now, you have been involved with them for a number of years. You were critically involved at a time when there was no discussion about faith and science in a formal way. And because of that, there have been...
In a formal, healthy way.
Okay, yeah, okay, I'll put it that. Yeah,
there was a lot of unhealthy approaches. But yeah,
we can't keep mentioning YouTube.
Yeah, exactly.
We were making a talking before the show about how there are these people who have widely pronounced great distrust of all kinds of science, and they are not ashamed to tell it to you on Facebook, on the internet, on broadcast, all products of science. Incredible amount of work was designed so that a guy can type on a laptop, "I don't think science is worth a darn." And it's the incongruity of it is really quite pathetic. But also, again, people always think of the Vatican as, you know, dark marble and musty rooms full of old books and things like that. How many different science disciplines are actively represented at the Vatican right now? We know astronomy is one of them. Well, do you know of any other ones?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. When a scientist is appointed to a position at the Vatican Observatory, the only charge that they're given is to do good science. So they're based on their background and their field of interest. It's less about the Vatican has, you know, it's not like the Pope has all these different things and gives them a list of this is what the Pope wants to know. That's not how the observatory works. Basically, they get within the Jesuit population, promising scientists to work for the observatory. So obviously, all of it is something to do with astronomy, but it can be very different. So, for example, I mentioned earlier, they do a lot of studies with meteorites. And so there's a lot of, you know, geology work that they do in terms of, you know, astrogeology and that kind of thing. And ironically, the work that they do is very important to the professional community because the Vatican Observatory doesn't need to beg for things like NASA funding or public funding for their projects. So they can do the less interesting science work that those bigger scientists need to have done, but the bigger scientists can't do it because it's not appealing enough for them to get grant money to actually do the lower stuff. So it's an interesting relationship on how a lot of the stuff in the professional world scientifically that the Vatican Observatory does, whether it's studying of asteroids or studying of the stars, would be considered on the professional level boring stuff. I mean, to me, it's fascinating, you know, but I mean, when you get into that upper level stuff, but it's foundational to what the bigger stuff you do hear more frequently in the media has to do. I know they have, for example, a scientist who is a meteorologist by trade that just came on, I think about 2 years ago when they brought him on. And so for him, he's looking not so much at astronomy from the perspective of looking out, but looking in, what do you see when you turn like a space telescope around and look at ourselves, and how can we get a better understanding of who we are? There's a, and then obviously with new technologies and that kind of stuff. So there's a broad range of scientists that they have, but it's not that the Vatican specifically wants, you know, we want a chemist, we want a physicist, or it's more of what are the gifts that the Jesuit order has scientifically, and how can those gifts be used in service of the church through the Vatican Observatory?
Yeah, I think years ago they used to talk about the difference between so-called pure science and practical science. Mm-hmm. Pure science is you are discovering something and it may or may not ever have any real practical use on the everyday world. And then you got the people who are saying, we've got to come up with a new polymer to make a nonstick surface for fry pans. You know, that's science. But one of the things that you might call pure science was, I think I mentioned at the beginning of the show, where they found this 2,000-year-old rock, actually it was a carved table, a small thing, in southern Vietnam. And they were able, using, I don't know, gas spectrometer, who knows, using science to get down to the tiny granular level of this rock, and not only discover there were particles or something of the herbs that were used, but they were able to sort them out and basically come up with a recipe. And they discovered that 2,000 years ago, they pretty much made curry the same way we have today.
And at the risk of sounding like I don't trust science, I would put that stone up against my mother's taste buds, because my mother has an uncanny ability by tasting something to figure out what ingredients are. So that'd be an interesting science experiment, you know, yeah. The spectroscopy versus my mother's sense of taste.
She'd lick the thing and go, oh, I know what this is. But yeah, and there is a certain amount of intuition that is a big part of science. What was the term they were banding about years ago? Heuristics, where if a person has had a lot of different experiences in their life, they may make a connect the dots between something that is totally separate from something else you'd never think of putting together. And I think that scientists, if they do enough general science and learning stuff, every once in a while they'll go, hey, wait a minute. And recently there was something in the news, and I'm not even going to try to describe it, but it has to do with so-called, and this is where Jack sounds like he knows what he's talking about, but he doesn't, space-time. Now, apparently Einstein said that space and time are related. There was a test I remember from years ago, and I'm going to give you the bare bones of it, and correct me if I'm wrong. They had two atomic clocks, which are incredibly precise, and they left one on the ground, and they put one in a very, very high-speed jet, and it flew for quite a while at a very, very high speed. And then they landed, and they put the clocks next to each other, and they were no longer synchronized. One was actually slower than the other one. And they're saying this is because the movement also altered time. Aside from watching a whole bunch of science fiction movies, that's beyond me. But now there's something else going on. Can you explain what this was involving time and space and, I guess, movement that kind of was a pretty big-time discovery?
Yeah, so basically, there's a couple things we can look at. The first, why is that phenomenon there? Why did that occur? And we know that the closer you get to the speed of light, the experience of time that somebody goes through changes significantly. And like, for example, we don't know how to do it now, but if you could get a human being to get just barely short of the speed of light, their aging process would significantly slow down to the point where if they would come back, they might have aged 2 or 3 years and everybody else has aged 50 years. And so therefore, we know scientifically that time, there's a relative understanding of it, that it's not a consistent. And the best science of today is leaning toward the idea of time as we know it, you know, like I got my wristwatch on and that kind of stuff. That sense of time very well could be an illusion. It could be something that is more of something we've constructed to make sure we aren't late for meetings and that kind of thing. And at times people can get scared when you hear that kind of stuff, but to believe it or not, St. Augustine actually hammered this idea out a long, long time ago when he in his writings stated that perhaps time isn't what we think it to be. But perhaps time is more of an observation of a change, whether that be a personal change, a physical change, a moral change, a spiritual change. And that change that we experience in the world around us or in our lives, we interpret as time. So, and ironically, because the modern science of today is speculating that time might be a function of observing decay. That as we see things decay and change in the physical world, the way that our minds have been groomed to comprehend that is this notion of time, to see how things decay over time. Now, granted, the modern science approach would be strictly physical, and to be quite frank, a little on the depressing side. St. Augustine is more of that sense of both the negative, physical change, death, that sort of thing, but also the positive, the spiritual change, the growth in holiness, the transformation of who we are as a people. So the irony is that as modern science is exploring this, there's a lot of things that some people just, oh, the world's never heard this before, the world's never thought of this before. But when you actually look at the history of human thought, yeah, maybe there's some new ways because of general relativity and that side. There's a new package that some of these ideas are being presented in that can actually be very powerful in advancing technologies, but really the concepts aren't terribly new and actually have surfaced before. So that's a little history lesson of time, I guess, yeah.
A couple of times now that Bishop Callahan has been on, and we were talking about saints and prayer and who prays for who and affecting whatever. And he mentioned that he says, you know, in heaven, he says, there is no time as we know it. Time has stopped. And that's a very interesting concept to think about that, you know, I can't imagine it. You know, it's very abstract at this point, but there's a lot of theology behind this, and yep. Someday we'll have to have a big discussion on that. But
welcome to what we speak of the great question: has the kingdom of heaven already been inaugurated? And in Catholic, the true Catholic answer to that is the great both and. Well, yes and no. Yes, through Christ's life, death, and resurrection, the kingdom has been established. But it hasn't been fully revealed to us until the end of time. And so we live as this odd creature with one foot in eternity and another foot in time. And the interesting thing is that not only modern science, but St. Augustine's thought gives us perhaps not the full answer, but a little insight into how that might work and how you can live both in an eternal reality, children of the kingdom as baptized Christians, but also live in the space of time that requires us to examine our moral lives, to change, to embrace a life of faith and so forth, and living in a world that is visibly decaying. And so it's interesting on how there are times when you can look at some of these things together and it can actually bring more clarity than confusion. You know, one of the things that, and I want to be careful that I don't end up venturing into the world of crack pottery, as I like to jokingly call it. But, you know, I oftentimes wonder, and I even am, you know, as I'm approaching 50 years old, I'm starting to even sense it in myself of, How many times have I heard, whether as a priest or before priesthood, when I have talked with people who are older, retired, approaching the end of their life, that, boy, it seems like time's speeding up. It seems like time's going faster. And then they're usually referencing on how there can be that disconnect between what the person was raised to understand, to believe, how the world functions, to how the world is functioning now. And I'm starting to go through that as I'm approaching 50, where I'm like, I'm not a young priest anymore. You know, I'm starting to feel a deep sense of disconnect with everything that's happening culturally and so forth. But I almost wonder too, if part of that whole relative sense of time is that maybe as we age, we do have that sense that time is different for us now than it was when we were children, when we were playing in the backyard and didn't have a care in the world, and our biggest concern was scraping our knee and making sure that it got bandaged up so we could go back out and play baseball with our friends, you know, and that type of thing. So
I think even when you are in your early 20s, time is different than it is when you're, say, 50 or 70 or whatever it is. It's your perception of the world. I think it's your experiences, the heuristics. So you're putting things together that you wouldn't put together when you were 20, and certainly not when you're 10. But it could be a possibility. We certainly feel that. Of course, around here, when you've got a house that was built in about 1880. there's always something breaking, you know, we've always got these various cats that have. We were kittens here, and now they're 13, and we're having to rush them over to the vet to have something taken care of, you know. And everything seems like you don't have time to get it done. Right. But also, we have heaped upon ourselves so much more stuff. We, quite frankly, and I'm not being a snob about this, we just don't have time to watch broadcast television. Ever since I think the X-Files were on, I used to watch that all the time in the first season or the second season. But when they began linking them together, where you had to watch the next week to find out what happened, that's when I stopped watching. Because I can't commit the time to be there at 8 o'clock every Tuesday. Yeah. You know, I have a thing called a life. The things to be done.
It's ironic you say that, because this past year I cut the cable at the rectory, and I did get the Bally Sports streaming service because I like baseball and basketball and sports. But, you know, so for me, if I get to catch a baseball game or a basketball game, that's great. But that's really about the only TV I watch. I do watch YouTube videos, because there's, among the garbage that's out there, there's actually some really good stuff out there to learn from. And that's worth it. So I loved when you mentioned how oftentimes people who rail against technology use technology to rail against technology. And it kind of reminds me of some YouTube talking heads I run into that talk about the evils of YouTube and how horrible it is. And make sure that you subscribe and hit the like button so you can hear me the next time that I can tell you how evil YouTube is. I'm like, wait a second, you're shooting yourself in the foot on what you're trying to do here. I mean, you know, you're using the very thing you're saying is wrong with the world, but you obviously are okay with it.
And right, yeah.
And that's why it's without anything in life. You know, there are healthy approaches and unhealthy approaches. There's healthy approaches to technology and unhealthy approaches to technology.
We do little public service announcements frequently talking about all the things the Diocese of La Crosse is doing. And for example, in the recent ordination, you could watch it on YouTube, stream live, and if you didn't catch it, you could go back and watch it being replayed. It was amazing. There are some things, I don't put it on a great deal. I get the biggest kick sometimes out of, they've got little replays of these, you know, America's Got Talent, the UK has got talent, Lower Slobobia has got talent. They're all over the place. But I always love the ones where somebody comes on and they have no expectations that they're going to be any good. And then they blow them away. You know, there were four guys on who were, they looked like gangbangers. I mean, they looked like the kind of guys you would walk on the other side of the street if you saw them. And they began doing a Bach chorale quartet. And it was the most amazing thing. And also to look at the judges' faces when somebody who comes on who doesn't look like they are capable of doing anything suddenly just says something stunning. It's always nice to do, because I think everybody has got some talents that are unrecognized. And there's something just encouraging about that, to see how much great stuff that goes on around us constantly and how many good people there are doing really neat things. And it's one small way of doing it, you know. That it's nice. But again, some people do not have the internet available or not reliably, and so you can't always stream everything. However, again, we keep broadcasting on the radio. And again, I mentioned it's incredible that this show is now available as a podcast, which is, again, this is done by the communications department, not by me. And Zach and the rest of them are over there. I was startled to discover that you could go to Amazon and go up, if you have a Prime membership, and you click on Amazon Music, Amazon Podcast, type in Connecting the Diocese, and there we are. It's kind of like, how did that happen? It's all science. It's all science. What else is going on in your world locally, and also what is going on in the world of space? What's the last thing that you that set you back looking, wow, look at that, when you were looking at what was happening outside of the Earth as well? What's going on first locally in the parish? Anything coming up?
Yeah, you know, the two things that are coming up, and I would encourage people to, and I'll see if I can send you a link, Jack, if there might be listeners that are interested, or possibly even you. But in Divine Mercy Sunday next year will also be the day of, for the United States, total solar eclipse.
Oh, wow.
And I actually am going to be down in, I believe it's in Indiana, in totality, giving a week long to talk about faith, science, solar eclipses, and to experience totality. Literally two rare experiences, one seeing totality, but also then doing it in the context of a retreat with Vatican Observatory scientists.
And we will have to not only front promote that, but front promote the event, because there will be people who, as they say, don't get the memo. And all they'll know is it's Divine Mercy Sunday and the sun is going away. Calling 911 and all kinds of things happen. I don't know whether it was a total eclipse 40 years ago or so. I was in Minneapolis and I got up on the roof of the building I was living in. And what was curious, because you know, you're looking out over the Minneapolis area, and as the sun kind of like went away, all over the place, dogs began howling. It was like dogs were going, this is not what's supposed to be. It was very strange. But you know,
I did a piece the last time we had a total solar eclipse in the United States. I did a piece for the Vatican Observatory, and one of the things I included, because as part of my therapy during COVID to kind of get me out of the house and not have me become stir crazy, was I got into wildlife photography. And they have, there's an organization that Cornell University runs called ebird.org that if you ever want to try to find a bird in the state of Wisconsin, go to ebird. But they had, during totality, all the birds that started doing their night songs during totality. And it was just really neat to see on how all of creation was literally responding to that event. And
I think that, again, this gets more into biology than anything else, but we really are deeply affected by nature, whether we want to admit it or not. And, you know, they keep talking about how it's really important to get outside. It's really, you should not spend your whole time in a house, in a square box, away from the sun. It's just not that good for you. And but the fact that, you know, there's things like, they talk about how the moon, the gravitational field of the moon, affects the tides. And then, they, you know, because they can actually raise, and it raises and lowers the tides. And this is the moon doing this. Now, you're 98% water.
Yep.
So we don't know. I'm not going to do any heuristics connecting the dots between those, but it's just something to think about, you know?
Yeah, you know, and it's a nice segue. One last thing I'm just going to actually ask both you, Jack, and your audience to pray for is the other thing going on with me, and then we'll get into your little wave analogy.
I'm sure, didn't you?
Of the thing that is our main topic for today. But just ask for some fun prayers from the listeners of Connecting the Diocese. I can't give too many details yet, but a major Catholic publishing house has reached out to me, and I'm working on my second book.
All right.
At the request of the publishing house, so a little bit different than last time. So.
That's a huge difference. As a person who has self-published a half a dozen how-to books on computers and cameras, when a publisher comes to you, that's just a really good sign.
And I was going to say, it's been such a, you know, interesting experience for me. One, it's a very trusted Catholic publication. So once people learn which house it was, it's, you know, Orthodox. It's right down the fairway in terms of church teaching. But also, too, the neat thing is it's going to be similar but different from my first book, where the first book was more of, for lack of a better term, reflections that could be more apologetic. Why is it reasonable to believe in faith and science? For this one, they're asking me to do more of a series of spiritual reflections on astronomy based on what we do in Arizona with the Faith and Astronomy Workshop, but in a way that focuses primarily on beauty to try to re-engage, especially younger people, but all Catholics, into a healthy understanding and appreciation of the night sky. And so it's going to be a little bit more of a fun, as I've said, I'm trying to take Scripture, Benedict XVI, Pope Francis, and John Muir, and throw them into a bowl and see what I get after we're done with everything. So.
Well, we can ask everybody to pray for Father Krasinski's inspiration to kick into high gear, to see things that he might have overlooked, to have the Holy Spirit say, hey, try this.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's wonderful. So, now, this is probably not a book that will be available this Christmas, unless they're really there, but maybe next year.
I'm closing in on the official proposal to get done. And then after that, presuming and being that the company reached out to me, they said that we need the proposal, but presume unless you're really biff it, it's going to get approved. And then after that, we can talk more publicly about what it's
going to be. Yeah, it takes a while. It takes a long time for stuff to get done. And it would be great to have it released on Divine Mercy Sunday during the total
eclipse. That would be fun. And I'll just call it the end of the world as we know it. I'm just lying. I'm not. It's a joke, people.
Your competitors, was the PR companies from other publishing houses, go, how did he manage to pull that one off? It went dark. No, we don't. It doesn't work that way, but that's a wonderful thing. We are in an interesting time. This is a little off topic, but not terribly. We're in an interesting time where it is terribly difficult to be commercially published. I mean, incredibly difficult. And to have a company come to you is a big difference. But at the same time, people who want to self-publish, whatever it's a novel or whatever it happens to be, you have to be extremely careful. Because there are tons of companies that says, we will publish your book. Well, yeah, they'll print it for you, but they're not going to do anything else. And frankly, even if the company comes to you, there will be a certain expectation that you, the author, have to spend some time promoting it as well. So if someone comes to you and says, you know, we think your book is incredible. Oh, this is the most fantastic book in the world. We're just going to print it for $18 a copy. Bad choice. Bad choice. It's like an onion skin. If you search around, you can get the copies. This is a black and white book. This is not a picture type thing. But you can get the cost down to a couple bucks or less. But just be careful. If people just start saying, oh, this is the most incredible book in the world, it's going to be like James Michener. No, it's probably not going to happen that way. And so be careful if you're a self-publisher. And you know, same thing with audiobooks and things like that. There's just a lot of people out there who are really not helping you out. There's a tremendous market right now, they say, for people to read audiobooks. No, there is not. There's a whole bunch of stars in Hollywood who make extra money reading those books. But just be careful with that. But when they come to you, if they knock on your door and they say, hey, that book is great, we want to fund the whole thing and put it together. That's a different ballgame. That's really cool. Yeah. Now, where would the images for this come from? Do you have any idea?
I'm creating them right now. And that's one of my frustrations with the Canadian wildfire smoke. It's robbed me of a lot of imaging time that I could. But, yeah, they want to be an image-heavy book, and so I'm actually The Vatican Observatory has some images we're going to incorporate that they've given me permission to use, but I'm also going to be using a lot of my own astrophotography.
Yeah, indeed. So. I'm reminded of the old song, God of Our Fathers, who, of shining worlds with splendor through the sky.
Yeah, exactly.
That's cool. That's really good. Now, if we can talk a little bit about this space-time thing, to come back to Earth a little bit closer, maybe your opinion of all of the craziness over AI stuff, but that's another, we'll talk about that in a few minutes. But what did they find out about expanding ripples in time? What is that?
And the irony is, you know, when you mentioned that we're made 98% of water, you know, I presume that with the news that was hitting lately, that, you know, people would intuitively developing these ideas that our new understanding of the universe is kind of like ocean waves and that kind of stuff. And with that, yes and no. As with all things with science, there's a certain familiarity between, like, for example, the shape of a galaxy and the shape of a seashell, but the seashell and the galaxy are fundamentally two very different things, and the more you study them, the more dissimilar they are than similar. But they found that through gravitational waves, and basically to kind of simplify a very complex idea, that we know that black holes exist. They figured out a way to image black holes, and they found out if black holes get too close to each other, they start to spin around each other super fast and will eventually collide and have a massive amount of energy release. Now, when they do that, that creates waves they call gravitational waves. Well, and that was a huge breakthrough. I think it was a few years ago when they did that. And those waves actually ripple through the entire universe. And so that's something we already knew. So, like, for example, if two black holes that were, you know, 100 million light years away collided, those waves would literally ripple through us in time. So we have actually, even though we can't feel them, because these are, to our eyes, are incredibly small little waves, they actually distort our bodies and distort the entire Earth, but at such a minute scale we can't perceive it. Well, now what they're starting to find after that huge, and it was a huge breakthrough in science, they're starting to find that just about everything in creation creates the waves. And instead of seeing it as like ocean waves, a better analogy based on what I've read so far would be more of like if you like to fish or you're out in a paddle boat and it's a really calm day and the waters are calm and you just have that childlike intuition to take your hand and just run it on top of the water and just kind of watch the little ripples go out from that. That's a better analogy from, you know, to use this, that there is in the fabric of space time, everything creates these little ripples throughout. Now, some people will be like, well, cool. Well, but what does that really matter? Well, and again, I told you earlier to be careful not to think of the universe as a giant ocean, but I do have to admit, I find it interesting that all of the galaxies are not on one flat plane. You know, we can see some galaxies from what we would call the top of the galaxy. We see some of them edge on, meaning that it's almost like they're parallel with us side by side. There's some that are tilted in certain directions. There's clusters of galaxies that are kind of, you know, the universe isn't a flat plane. There's this certain undulation that we see in how everything interacts with us. And so be careful about taking the wave analogy too far in terms of ocean waves. But I think it's safe to say that this just confirms that our universe is far more interesting than we oftentimes give it credit for. And this understanding of gravitational waves and how they impact the material world is going to, again, further our understanding of God's creation in a positive way to help us to, you know, from a standpoint of faith, we explore the why questions. Why did God do all this? And then that's when we get into salvation history and those type of things. But there is a normal, healthy human curiosity of, well, how did God do it? You know, yeah, you know, what went into God's ancient curry that led to all this, and how does this all function? And so that's an important understanding of a way of understanding God's operations in our world too.
Well, these waves are very subtle. I mentioned the experiment with the two atomic clocks and how they didn't match. They were not off by like 5 minutes. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. They were off by a tiny, tiny amount. So, for example, if a gravitational wave was to suddenly pass through you, it probably doesn't mean that tomorrow morning your pants won't fit.
Sadly, I mean, if it meant me losing weight, that'd be great. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
And I'm beginning to, I'm sorry, you know, my mind begins to not rebel against this, but my mind, when it tries to conceive of these things and not do it, you keep thinking about maybe the universe. I can just see a big consortium at the Vatican Observatory and the guy going, maybe the universe is like the inside of a big lava lamp.
It's interesting you bring that up, because that's not the first time I've heard that analogy being done.
Well, you see, I'm right on top of it. I leave it to some stupid radio guy to come up with the dumbest thing he can think of, and oh yeah, there you go. But
because even like for example, you know, when the classic classroom analogy when you're teaching the expansion of the universe is that astronomy teachers will take in a balloon, they'll blow it up first, and then they'll like put all, you know, take a Sharpie and put all these dots on it to represent stars and that kind of stuff. And then they'll deflate it, and then they'll blow it up in their classroom to, well, okay, so this is, we started with nothing, but then, you know, there's expansion. And when you think about that, they're again, builds certain presumptions. Oh, so it expands universally in a circle with equal expansion in every direction. Well, we're actually finding now that's, yes, the universe is expanding, but it's not like a balloon uniformly expanding. Some parts of it are expanding at, you know, in different directions and different ways, and it's a little bit more like a lava lamp look, you know, versus this pristine balloon that's expanding out. It's, you know, it's a little bit more fascinating, I guess.
Yeah, it is. And we've always, it seems like, we've practically from the invention of the wheel, we have always had this mechanical view of things, like, you know, expanding equally and around. And, you know, this is how we work with the physical world that we're in. You have a real hard time making a triangular tire that's going to run very well. And so you do stuff that's very practical. And that, all around us, everything that we see, other furniture and everything, is perceptions that we expect. We assume everything is the way it is. We keep hearing things about how, you know, everything is held together through, you know, atomic fields. And basically, you know, there's a very practical reason why you can't push your hand through a wall, at least not without breaking it, or your hand, that is. But technically, you know, we are all made of the same stuff, which is great fun. There was
what you're talking about reminds me of the late Father Edward T. Oakes, Jesuit. He was one of our professors at Mundelein Seminary and wrote for First Things magazine. And in his contemporary theology class, he talked about heuristic handles, meaning things that we use that in and of themselves, we know intuitively aren't accurate, but the use of them throws us into something that's far more accurate, you know? And he said, and so like, for example, my little balloon analogy, anybody who teaches astronomy knows that isn't how the universe actually expands. But the visualization to the student of that expansion, even though it's not perfect, gets the student to understand the deeper reality that we live in an expanding universe. And then you can use that as the starting point to explain the far more complex universe that we live in. And he said, at the risk of scandalizing some, he said that's kind of how the parables function in Scripture when you think about it, you know, because there are they quote unquote true stories. Well, the whole point of the parable is that it's a story that tries to take your mind in one direction, but then Christ uses it to elevate your mind to the kingdom in the way that goes way beyond the story he's using. This past Sunday, as we're recording this, the parable of the mustard seed and of the leaven and the dough, so we know intuitively the kingdom of heaven isn't a mustard seed, but the use of that symbol gives the human mind that's limited to the physical the opportunity to move to the metaphysical, to grasp something far truer than the mustard seed parable that impacts our lives and becomes part of our vision of where we're heading and where we're striving for.
Yeah, and the Catholic faith and church is absolutely filled with all kinds of spiritual disciplines, spiritual explanations, all kinds of things for different people's temperaments. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing wrong with that. There are analogies, and I can't think of any symbolisms, and just you name it. I mean, look at the just making the sign of the cross. I've always been fascinated by that ever since RCIA days. There's just so much of it, and you go in and you watch something going like the Chrism Mass. You talk about the richness of the symbolism and all the things going on. But just like you say, the parallels of Jesus. The stories are in there. They're just unbelievably good. And mm-hmm. You can take them at their face value, and you can say there's a good moral story there. But, boy, there's some deeper symbolism beneath those. And it doesn't invalidate them being used the other way.
Yep.
That's the neat thing about it. It's as deep into
And the neat thing about them is you know that Jesus is using it precisely in that way. He's not saying the mustard seed or the kingdom of heaven is a mustard seed. The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed. The expansion of the universe is like blowing up a balloon with all the dots on the outside. It's not, but here's a little way into it with an image that is insufficient to bring you to a deeper sense of the depth of what the truth is. And that's, when you think about it, that's the best sense of what we would call rhetoric. You know, rhetoric has gotten a bad name over the years because oftentimes rhetoric becomes something in a debate that's untrue. But the best of rhetoric is to use something that draws the mind in one direction but brings you to a deeper truth by the end of it.
Just a simple phrase that we all banter around all the time about God is love. You know, there's unconditional love. There's all different kinds of, and the idea of true unconditional anything is mind-boggling. The idea that there's a thing that this did not come from a Christian tradition, but I've always remembered from my studies of the Eastern religions, and it was simply that I'm going to use words that are more common to us. Filled with God are the things we see. Filled with God are the things we don't see. Mm-hmm. From out of God flows all that is. From God, everything, and yet God is still the same.
Yep.
And that's, boy, I'll tell you can sit on that one for a while and think about it.
Welcome to the type of space that you need to think about how can we live in both time and non-time at the same time? How can we, understand that as we're sitting here, tiny little gravitational waves are rippling through both of us as we speak, and we don't have a clue what's going on, but it is actually contorting our bodies in minuscule ways and contorting our universe, kind of like the hand passing through the water. Are gravitational waves the hand passing through the water? No, but it's an analogy that can start to jolt our mind into a deeper understanding of our created world and to contribute to that understanding of the question, not of why did God do everything, but how did God pull all this off? So they're both important questions to explore.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, I am still waiting for the invention of anti-gravity.
I tell you what, it sounds like, granted, it might not happen within our lifetimes, but there's been some breakthroughs on tiny little fusion reactors that might change the landscape of fusion-powered cars.
But, I still want a flying car. I've been waiting now, since I was six. Come on, guys, it's about time. The bad news with stuff like that is there's bad enough drivers out there right now. Can you imagine them flying, and staying in their lanes, up and down, left and right,
when there are no lanes?
I
think you and I just watch the Jetsons too much.
I think so.
Just kind of like.
And I will tell you before we head out that for years, as long as I can remember, even in the early 50s, they kept trying to come up with ways for individuals, like mostly military guys, to fly by themselves. In the 50s, they had these platforms with two sets of propellers running in two different directions and a guy standing on top, and he had to hang on to like this round hoop that was up there, and this would lift him off the ground, right? The last day I was in the military, I literally signed out that I was sane, healthy, and ready to go. I was in Fort Myer, Virginia, and I walk out the door and I hear a rushing noise ahead of me. I look up in the sky and there's a guy flying. And he doesn't have a plane. He has a jetpack on.
Yeah.
What was going on? There was a company from Minneapolis called the Terry Team. This was the anniversary of the Wright brothers demonstrating their first plane to the Army on that same field. And they had this guy flying around with this jetpack, kind of a James Bond type thing. The only trouble was that this thing weighed a whole bunch. I mean, it was a big, heavy thing he had on his back. In order for him to land, he had to land into a special cradle.
Mm-hmm.
So this is called, no, this is not going to work for hopping over to Quick Trip, We got ways to go. But Father, we had a good talk this time. We're going to have to talk some other time about AI stuff. That's a whole new ball.
I was going to say, too, just with that analogy that you mentioned to close out, a little tease for maybe a conversation you and I can have in the future. I know that right now people are asking me a lot about all the stuff about UFOs and UAPs.
Oh, yeah.
What do I think about it and that kind of stuff? And, your analogy of the jetpack reminds me that when I go down to Tucson for the Faith and Astronomy workshops, I like to take like a day before and a day after to just do some vacation time. And one of my favorite places to go is the Air Force has what's called the Boneyard outside of Tucson, where all the retired military jets and stuff go. And I remember I saw there was a whole line of F-16s on this tour. And they said, Father, guess what we're going to be using those F-16 for? Like, well, those are going to be our next generation drones.
Oh, my.
And they're outfitting. And to me, it was both amazing and terrifying all at the same time, because they were explaining to me, oh, yeah, because if you have it as drones, there's no more G-force issues. These jets can pull a lot more G's without a human in them than with, and that kind of stuff. And then, so then when we hear things about like flying Tic Tacs and all that kind of stuff, and don't get me wrong, I like Star Trek just as much as anybody else does. But the thing that is, when I first started hearing all that stuff, I just wanted to dismiss it. Just, with some bored kids playing with drones or something like that. But then when the Pentagon is saying, well, actually, there are some things out there that we don't know what they are. And the thing that scares me a little bit isn't about aliens, but just there are things similar to your jetpack, similar to these F-16 drones. We don't know what they are. They have this odd frequency around military active bases, and not just any military base, but like really high end, and it's one of those things where when people ask me, I'm like, you bet we need to understand what this is, but don't go looking for my favorite Martian yet. The most common misidentified UFO after Venus was the B-2 bomber. And, and we can get into that whole thing because it leads to conversations about, well, does the Catholic Church, are we open to life outside of us.
And right.
That's could there be for a future conversation.
Yeah. Could there be an unmanned probe coming to visit someday or something like that? That's good.
Exactly.
Father James Krasinski, thank you so much for being here. I will keep in touch. And as I always tell people, if anything extraordinary pops up that you need to get talked about or you want us to know about, even at your parish, for example, reminder about Divine Mercy Sunday next year, give me a holler. I can get it on the air pretty quickly as well.
Sounds good.
All right, hang on a second. I'll be right back. Got some pretty late breaking news from the Catholic News Agency. There is a new Catholic Charities USA head. It's a laywoman with leadership and philanthropy background. Carrie Alice Robinson is the new president and CEO of Catholic Charities USA. Now, this is not to be confused with Catholic Charities for the Diocese of La Crosse. This is Catholic Charities, the whole thing, USA. And the press release describes Catholic Charities as the domestic humanitarian arm of the Catholic Church in the U.S., whose affiliates serve more than 15 million people per year. Robinson said recently, "The Gospels call Catholics and all people of goodwill to serve those most in need of our aid." The staff and volunteers of Catholic Charities agencies around the country answer that call every day, feeding the hungry, comforting the afflicted, and welcoming the stranger. I am deeply honored and profoundly humbled to be part of this life-giving mission, unquote. This hour, we've been talking about how the average person out there doesn't realize how involved in science the Catholic Church is. They also probably don't realize what a job the Church does through Catholic Charities as well, all over the country. Catholic Charities has 167 member agencies and 3,900 locations across the U.S., including 5 U.S. territories. The agencies are engaged in a variety of projects, including hunger relief, housing assistance, that's a big one right now, disaster aid, health care, job training, and assistance for migrants and refugees. And we've learned that one, of course, hearing about what happened at Fort McCoy with the Afghan refugees and Catholic Charities. A board chairman at Catholic Charities said, "We are confident that the Catholic Charities Network and the millions of vulnerable people it serves each year will be greatly benefiting from Carrie's extraordinary passion, expertise, and insight. I wish her well." You know, all this talk about God permeating the universe just is begging for me to play this song, so I'll catch you next week, right here on Connecting the Diocese.
Pestilence, be thy strong arm.